Campus FM presents My Pizza and Toffee Apples in the 1950s. Produced and presented by Patricia Salomone.
In the long, quiet evenings before the advent of television, my father listened to the BBC News and my mother played Chopin on our piano. Her music drifted out through the open windows into the dark summer nights, lit up only here and there by the dim lights in the British military barracks opposite our home. From my bedroom window, while I did my homework on the green table, I could hear young men's voices laughing in the distance. Why so much laughing? Ho, 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 ha, 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 from the officers' mess across the moat, beyond the barbed wire. There was much clicking of glasses, and a faint smell of gin and tonic floated on the warm summer air to my little girl's pink and lilac bedroom. In a building typical of the military architecture, complete with arched verandas, was housed the Tenier officers' mess. A narrow road led to it from the Quisisana side and exited in Tenier, which they called Tini. So for us kids, this was a thrilling shortcut. Running through it, without being scolded by a soldier on guard, and in contravention to our parents' orders, felt like a victory. That was forbidden ground on which we were not to tread.
Night and day, you are the one. Only you beneath the moon and under the sun. Whether near to me or far, it's no matter, darling, where you are. I think of you day and night.
One morning, she woke up and told us she had had a dream. She had seen bright lights and multinational flags beyond the moat, and no barbed wire there. A few years later, quite unknown to us then, that dream was to become a reality. By the end of the century, Quisisana would undergo a complete transformation. Five-star hotels and apartment blocks would change the skyline, and our MacIver flats now seem old and decrepit, dwarfed as they are by the new developments.
In the roaring traffic's boom, or in the silence of my lonely room, I think of you day and night.
Also, in those days, when the breeze blew from the sea, it brought the sound of the saxophone and the band playing at the chalet. It brought visions of ladies in evening gowns floating on the dance floor on the arms of handsome soldiers. Also, visions of ice cream served in metal cups shaped like champagne glasses, dripping cold drops of water onto metal trays. At times we would be taken there, my little sister and I, wearing broderie anglaise dresses with flowers in our hair, to have a Wembley ice cream, pink and green, and served with a pink rectangular cracker biscuit, as we sat on the folding chairs around the little round tables.
And its torment won't be through till you let me spend my life making love to you day and night, night and day.
My sister was small and pretty, with lovely smooth auburn hair, always combed pageboy style. To me, she was a living Snow White. My hair, on the other hand, thick and unruly, never seemed right. She was dainty, and she danced like a fairy. I was clumsy and had the habit of tearing my knees open. But then, I was the leader of the gang. How else could I be? A kind of Joan of Arc, always sticking up for the weaker ones at school. A jack of all trades, as old Tia Ross once called me.
And its torment won't ever be through till you let me spend my life making love to you day and night, night and day.
I would have loved to take ballet lessons at Princess Natalie Putsiatin. But cash was always short, and I had to be content with just owning a pair of pink dancing shoes and pretend that I was a ballerina, dancing rather clumsily in front of the mirror. The princess, as she was known in Slema, can be credited with being the founder of the art of ballet dancing in Malta. I remember seeing her sometimes, tall and rather buxom, walking along the Slema seafront with her mother, Princess Olga, and their lady-in-waiting. All three ladies looked very distinguished, their skin very light, their hair very light, and their clothes also very light, in shades of beige and soft pink. These noble ladies had come to Malta in 1919, just after the Russian Revolution, on a ship, the SS Bermudian, that had left the Black Sea for Britain and France. They walked slowly and lightly like well-trained ballerinas. Dance had been part of their schooling, together with French and embroidery. Years later, the princess told me how they found the light too bright and the floor too hard in Malta. They had been used to the carpeted parquet floors in their grand palaces and the lawns of their cured gardens. They took refuge here, in Little Malta, from that huge country, when revolution threatened their lives and destroyed forever their sheltered way of life. Here, an imperial princess became a ballerina who worked to earn her living. Yet, her contribution to the Maltese social development was enormous. She was to leave the gift of her art to generations of Maltese dancers. Such are the unexpected twists of life. In truth, to console me for not attending a real ballet school, my mother took me to her friend, a beautiful English lady whose husband was an Air Force officer, complete with red moustache and whiskey glass always in hand. This lady had been a dancer, and between a cup of tea and a chat with my mum, she happily gave me my first and only lessons in the five positions of ballet. I looked forward to those lessons and took my pink ballet shoe with me each time we visited. But one day, the shocking news was whispered behind my back that this lady had leapt off her roof into the small yard below in her home in the heart of Slema. Her little Chihuahua dog would not let the police or medical personnel near her as she lay lifeless, her beauty wasted, and my ballet dreams shattered on the floor of the narrow yard of a large house in the heart of Sliema. In those days, young couple as my mum and dad were, would go out in the evening dancing someplace, the Phoenicia Ballroom, the Mocambo in Valletta, the Union Club in Sliema. But they were also frequently invited to parties on board visiting naval vessels. Several friends who were officers on board those ships. A frequent visitor was an Indian naval officer who I called Uncle Socky. I was fascinated. He wore a turban and had sparkling dark eyes, and I was told that he had never cut his hair. My parents danced on board visiting British naval ships in Malsamshet Harbour, and later years they danced on the visiting Italian naval ships. While the adults were out in the evenings, Le Bambine would be left home with Speranza, our beloved housemaid, who learnt Italian from her signora, and fell in love with the handsome Italian sailors who, visiting from Taranto, brought us parcels full of Italian culinary delights. Dried figs stuffed with almonds, and calabrese sausage flavored with hot red pepper, spaghetti, orecchiette, and liters of olive oil. They brought wedding souvenirs with sugared almonds from the weddings of distant cousins, festivities we read about in Nonna's weekly letters. And they brought us the first panettones at Christmas, colombe and marzipan holy lambs at Easter time. On New Year's Eve, Spe would sleep with us while our parents went out to dance away the night. She slept in our pink bedroom on a camp bed, which had been my dad's during his war years in India. She would set up her camp bed between our two beds, and we would play snakes and ladders on this funny bed until, at midnight, something magic happened. Suddenly, all the sirens from the British ships in harbour would salute the new year. The searchlight from the dockyard, reminiscent of war years, would send up its ray across the Maltese sky, and fireworks would lighten up the sky over the Valletta skyline. Then we stood wide-eyed at the open window, leaning on the windowsill, and watching and listening in the cold, until silence reigned once more, and our sleepy eyes prompted Speranza to lay us down to sleep in our pink-flowered, cozy beds, made even warmer by the military blankets from Dad's days in the army.
Should old acquaintance be forgotten and never brought to mind? Should old acquaintance be forgot and old lang syne?
Next morning was a new day, a new year, a new step towards life. Every year on the 1st of January, the family would move, lock, stock and barrel, to my aunt's house, which was the traditional meeting place for the New Year's Day meal. Again, we would meet the family oldies, and how we looked forward to meeting Tia Ross again.
And surely
yet for all anxiety.
Tia Rose was my grandfather's sister and was about a foot taller than he. Big, loud and big-bosomed, she would appear at Christmas when the whole family was reunited in the family home in Tinier Seafront, and on New Year's Day at my aunt's in St. Mary Street. She would come by taxi all the way from Mouston, together with her diminutive sister Agnes and her handsome, sad brother Paul. These two paled to our eyes, for it was Tia Rose who won our hearts and our attention. To our delight, she would pull balloons out of her pockets and, blowing them up, distribute them to our eager waiting hands. At times, there were little sweets and halfpenny toys, fount of great excitement for us kids, because she was so jolly and funny and so big. One day, when my childhood was towards its end and the teens were close, in that time between childhood and womanhood, during the family Christmas reunion, Big Tia Rose coined the historic phrase describing me as Pat, Jack of all trades. Little did she know how right I was to prove her. The character of my family Christmases was Theo Faustine, a Capuchin friar, my handsome Uncle Guido's uncle. In my childhood years, he appeared to my mind as a sort of Father Christmas. On Christmas Day, he would wear his monk's hood over his little balding head, enter the big warm sitting room, and begin pulling peanuts and sweets from his long sleeves. He blew into his hands and out came little paper trumpets and sweets and toys. He was a magician in a poor friar's dress. He had a red nose and red cheeks. He also had a beard, quite like the images of Father Christmas, that the Father Christmas that I knew. But the colours were wrong. Besides, he wore no boots but sandals, summer and winter. Grown-ups said he had talent because he was an artist. His works of art were hung around my aunt's home. There were poor children, bare-bottomed and rosy-cheeked, eating apples. They were copies of famous works by Edward Caruana Dingley, his more famous contemporary. These paintings hung along the corridor of my aunt's flat in St. Mary Street, where we all convened for our gargantuan meal on New Year's Day. Theo Faustine's paintings are tied up to my New Year's Day recollections. Invariably, I felt a sense of pity for that little boy whose parents must have been so poor as not even to provide him with a pair of pants. This child's rounded bare bottom mixes with recollections of endless games of tombola around Auntie Margaret's table on New Year's Day. We played for hours, young and old members of the different generations of the family. And the prizes were not much, a threepence or a sixpence coin or a wagon wheel chocolate biscuit. Throughout the year, My grandparents' big sitting room in the big house in Tinia Seafront was closed. I could only peep at it through the small glass pane that made up the dividing door. So it was a particularly exciting time for me. If on Christmas Day, I got to my grandparents' home in Tinia early, before the arrival of the Light Brigade. The room smelt of woolen carpets and mothballs. On the mantelpiece, a clock rhythmically ticked away the time. There was a big gilt and black mirror which rose above a gilt and black sotto specchio. The baby grand piano stood in a corner, black and shiny, waiting for my Auntie Mona or Cousin Amy to play my grandfather's and my father's favourite classic pieces. Of biscuit statuettes fascinated me. A rosy little boy wearing light blue breeches and a pretty girl wearing a hat and sucking her thumb. They stood on the mirrored sotto specchio and shook their heads as we moved around in the room. In the middle of the room there was a little round leather-topped table on which stood polished brass and silver trinkets, always the same, year after year. My favorite was a silver cigarette box with a printer's etching forming the lid. There was also always a little crystal vase with perfumed narcissus from the garden. Their pungent smell was the perfume of Christmas. As Christmas Day progressed, the big sitting room, with its old Indian carpets, filled to capacity. Elderly uncles and aunts, young pretty girl cousins, handsome blue-eyed or dark-skinned boy cousins, turned up from all over the island to wish C.O. Walt a happy Christmas. C.O. Walt was my grandfather, a minister in the Strickland administration in earlier days. He was the king of the Christmas. Nanu Walter just loved the pomp and ceremony of it all. On Christmas Day he played host to hosts of Bonellos and Buzietas and Pizzutos and Mitsud Bonicis. The little girls came in red, navy or dark green velvet dresses with lace collars. Others wore pleated kilts with beautifully hand-knitted cardigans. They all wore their gold chain with a golden crucifix that they had received for their first Holy Communion. The boys had their hair neatly combed. They wore shorts, and their legs were blue with cold. Only as they grew older, they were allowed to wear long trousers, which always seemed too short at the ankles. This coincided, more or less, with the time when they were old enough to receive a Christmas gift, a great novelty of those days, an electric shaver.
Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh.
For weeks, leading up to the 25th December, Nanno sat patiently in his workshop, setting up his presepio, made up of millions of small pieces of cork, put together to form the most beautiful imaginary Holy Land, around the most famous stable in mankind's history.
In the air, a cloud of snow,
In Nanna Walter's crib, there were little lights in the stable, in the mill and uphill in the Three Kings' castle. There were rivers and farms, homes and barns. The carpenter's workshop was complete, with work table and tools, and the rabbit hutch contained miniature cabbages and carrots for the little creatures to eat. There was the washerwoman washing the babe's clothes by the little lake, and the shepherd shading his eyes from the star's bright light. There were rows of white sheep feeding on the grass, whilst the lazy shepherd, large Eptal Millet, slept completely unaware of the wonder about him. There were six little children, wide-eyed with wonder, year in, year out, standing by that big table. Each year we grew a little taller, until our vision of the whole crib took the dimension of a bird's-eye view. Time came that I was more interested in the handsome cousins visiting on Christmas Day than in the little lights in the crib. Year in, year out, happy voices greeted in the Christmas cheer, in Maltese, in English, in Italian. Silence fell as the little glasses of vermouth were served on a silver tray. Then Nanna Walter would cut open the Christmas pudding, amidst cheers of Happy Christmas. Who was to be the lucky one to find the hidden sixpence coin? Was it blonde Agnes, the prettiest of the lot, or little Arthur, tall and lanky? Taking backstage, as if detached from the general chair, Nanna Melita observed, watched and listened in her wise and silent manner. I shall tell you more about our life and Christmases in the next program. Till then, goodbye.